salsa dance without failing. You can't learn to be an inventor, or a nurse, or a scientist, without failing. Nor can you learn to transform the way products are developed in your firm, or change minds about urban poverty, or restore loving communication with your spouse without failing. And the elephant really, really hates to fail. This presents a difficulty for you when you are trying to change or when you're trying to lead change. You know that you or your audience will fail, and you know that the failure will trigger the flight instinct, just as the two of us fled our salsa lessons. How do you keep the elephant motivated when it faces a long, treacherous road? The answer may sound strange. You need to create the expectation of failure. Not the failure of the mission itself, but failure en route. This notion takes us into a fascinating area of research that is likely to change the way you view the world. 8. Write down the following four sentences, whether you agree or disagree with each of them. 1. You are a certain kind of person. There is not much that can be done to really change that. 2. No matter what kind of person you are, you can always change substantially. 3. You can do things differently, but the important parts of who you are can't really be changed. 4. You can always change basic things about the kind of person you are. If you agree with items 1 and 3, you're someone who has a fixed mindset. And if you agree with items 2 and 4, you tend to have a growth mindset. If you agreed with both 1 and 2, you're confused. As we'll see, which mindset you have can help determine how easy it will be for you to handle failure and how dogged you'll be in pursuing change. It might even determine how successful you are in your career. People who have a fixed mindset believe that their abilities are basically static. Maybe you believe you're a pretty good public speaker, an average manager, and a wonderful organizer. With a fixed mindset, you believe that you may get a little bit better or worse at those skills, but basically, your abilities reflect the way you're wired. Your behavior, then, is a good representation of your natural ability, just as the swirled and sniffed first taste of wine is a good representation of the bottle you've bought. If you are someone with a fixed mindset, you tend to avoid challenges, because if you fail, you fear that others will see your failure as an indication of your true ability and see you as a loser, just as a bad first taste of wine leads you to reject the bottle. You feel threatened by negative feedback because it seems as if the critics are saying they're better than you, positioning themselves at a level of natural ability higher than yours. You try not to be seen exerting too much effort. People who are really good don't need to try that hard, right? Think about tennis player John McEnroe as a young star. He had great natural ability, but was not keen on rigorous practice or self-improvement. In contrast, people who have a growth mindset believe that abilities are like muscles. They can be built up with practice. That is, with concerted effort, you can make yourself better at writing, or managing, or listening to your spouse. With a growth mindset, you tend to accept more challenges despite the risk of failure. After all, when you try and fail to lift more weight at the gym, you don't worry that everybody will mock you as a born weakling. You seek out stretch assignments at work, and you're more inclined to accept criticism because ultimately it makes you better. You may not be as good as others right now, but you're thinking long-term in a tortoise versus hare kind of way. Think Tiger Woods, who won 8 major championships faster than anyone in history and then decided his swing needed an overhaul. Fixed versus growth. Which are you? This isn't one of those Cosmo personality quizzes in which there are no wrong answers. Are you a Labrador Retriever or a poodle? Carol Dweck, a professor of psychology at Stanford University, has spent her career studying these two mindsets. She is the source of the terms, and her research results are clear. If you want to reach your full potential, you need a growth mindset. Dweck has studied how these two mindsets influence the performance of Olympic athletes and virtuoso musicians and everyday business people. In her must-read book, Mindset, The New Psychology of Success, she makes an airtight case that a growth mindset will make you more successful at almost anything. That's because people with a growth mindset, those who stretch themselves, take risks, accept feedback, and take the long-term view can't help but progress in their lives and careers. Once you become aware of these concepts, you start to spot the fixed mindset everywhere. Look at the way we praise our children. You're so smart. You are so good at basketball. That's fuel for the fixed mindset. A growth mindset compliment praises effort rather than natural skill. I'm proud of how hard you worked on that project. I could tell you listened to your coach's comments. You really had your elbow under those jump shots today. Our salsa dancing experience was a classic example of a fixed mindset failure. After trying an unfamiliar movement for a while, we concluded, definitely, that we were terrible salsa dancers and were born that way. And we quit, because letting other people see that natural lack of ability made us uncomfortable. Someone with a growth mindset never would have jumped to this conclusion. In fact, they never would have expected to be any good at salsa early on. The mindset would make all the difference. Which, of course, prompts an obvious question. Can people with a fixed mindset learn to adopt a growth mindset? 9. In 2007, Dweck and two colleagues, Khalid Tresnevsky of Stanford and Lisa Blackwell of Columbia, decided to run an experiment on junior high school students. If they trained the students on the growth mindset, would the kids get better at math? Junior high is, as you know, a tough transition time for kids. Most people have decidedly mixed memories of junior high, and 40% of people actually rank adolescence as the worst time in their lives. Presumably the other 60% didn't have acne. Just as puberty begins to kick in, students move to new schools with harder work and a new crop of teachers who don't give them the warm individual attention they got used to in elementary school. Junior high is a turning point for fixed mindset kids. Dweck found that in elementary school, fixed mindset students do about as well as growth mindset students, but in junior high, suffer an immediate drop in grades and then continue to slide in the next few years. The students in Dweck's study often came up with fixed mindset explanations for their decline. I am the stupidest. I suck in math. Notice how they're talking about their abilities as permanent traits, as if they were saying, my eyes are brown. Other students tended to place the blame elsewhere, saying things like, I don't do well because the teacher is on crack, or my math teacher is a fat male slut. Dweck and her colleagues set up a study for 7th grade math students in a school where 79% of students were eligible for the federal free lunch program, exactly the kind of low socioeconomic environment in which students are at risk for starting a pattern of academic failure. The control group was taught generic study skills, and the experimental group was taught the growth mindset. The growth mindset students were taught that the brain is like a muscle that can be developed with exercise, that with work, they could get smarter. After all, Dweck told them, nobody laughs at babies and says how dumb they are because they can't talk. Classroom mentors asked the students to think about skills they already had learned. Remember when you first stepped onto a skateboard or played Guitar Hero? And to recall how practice had been the key to mastering those skills. Students were reminded that everything is hard before it is easy, and that they should never give up because they didn't master something immediately. In total, the students in the growth mindset group received 2 hours of brain-is-like-a-muscle training over 8 weeks, and the results, astonishing. Students in the control group who were taught generic study skills started out their 7th grade year with math grades at about a C-plus level. Over the course of the year, their grades slipped to a C and then toward C-minus. The brain-is-like-a-muscle training, however, stopped this slide and reversed it. The students who received it significantly outperformed their peers. Some students made dramatic transformations. In mindset, Dweck reported, one day we were introducing the growth mindset to a new group of students. All at once, Jimmy, the most hardcore, turned-off, low-effort kid in the group, looked up with tears in his eyes and said, you mean I don't have to be dumb? From that day on, he worked. He started staying up late to do his homework, which he never used to bother with at all. He started handing in assignments early so he could get feedback and revise them. These kids now believe that working hard was not something that made you vulnerable, but something that made you smarter. The teachers, unaware of the experimental conditions their students were assigned to, were asked to identify the students who they thought had experienced a positive change during the spring term. 76% of the students they identified were in the Brain is Like a Muscle training group. Those results were dramatically out of proportion with the intervention itself. Math is a cumulative topic, after all, and the students in this experiment were already a third of the way into the spring term. 2 hours of instruction in the junior high sandstorm of hormones and popularity and YouTube should have had all the transformative effect of an after-school lecture on the food pyramid. Instead, 2 hours of training in how to think about intelligence made students demonstrably better at math. Dweck proved that the growth mindset can be taught and that it can change lives. 10. In the business world, we implicitly reject the growth mindset. Business people think in terms of two stages. You plan, and then you execute. There's no learning stage or practice stage in the middle. From the business perspective, practice looks like poor execution. Results are the real thing. We don't care how you do it, just get it done. But to create and sustain change, you've got to act more like a coach and less like a scorekeeper. You've got to embrace a growth mindset and instill it in your team. Why is that so critical? Because, as Harvard Business School professor Rosabeth Moss Cantor observes in studying large organizations, everything can look like a failure in the middle. A similar sentiment is expressed by marriage therapist Michelle Wiener Davis, who says that real change, the kind that sticks, is often 3 steps forward and 2 steps back. If failure is a necessary part of change, then the way people understand failure is critical. The leaders at IDEO, the world's preeminent product design firm, have designed products and experiences ranging from the first Apple mouse to a new Red Cross blood donation procedure. They understand the need to prepare their employees, and more important, their clients, for failure. Tim Brown, the CEO of IDEO, says that every design process goes through foggy periods. One of IDEO's designers even sketched out a project mood chart that predicts how people will feel at different phases of a project. It's a U-shaped curve with a peak of positive emotion labeled hope at the beginning and a second peak of positive emotion labeled confidence at the end. In between the two peaks is a negative emotional valley labeled insight. Brown says that design is rarely a graceful leap from height to height. When a team embarks on a new project, team members are filled with hope and optimism as they start to collect data and observe real people struggling with existing products. They find that new ideas spring forth effortlessly. Then comes the difficult task of integrating all those fresh ideas into a coherent new design. At this insight stage, it's easy to get depressed because insight doesn't always strike immediately. The project often feels like a failure in the middle. But if the team persists through this valley of angst and doubt, it eventually emerges with a growing sense of momentum. Team members begin to test out their new designs, and they realize the improvements they've made, and they keep tweaking the design to make it better. And they come to realize, we've cracked this problem. That's when the team reaches the peak of confidence. Notice what team leaders at IDEO are doing with the peaks and valley visual. They're creating the expectation of failure. They are telling team members not to trust that initial flush of good feeling at the beginning of the project, because what comes next is hardship and toil and frustration. Yet, strangely enough, when they deliver this warning, it comes across as optimistic. That's the paradox of the growth mindset. Although it seems to draw attention to failure, and in fact encourages us to seek out failure, it is unflaggingly optimistic. We will struggle, we will fail, and we will be knocked down. But throughout, we'll get better, and we'll succeed in the end. The growth mindset, then, is a buffer against defeatism. It reframes failure as a natural part of the change process. And that's critical, because people will persevere only if they perceive falling down as learning rather than as failing. This lesson was learned the hard way by several hospitals that were trying to embrace a new kind of heart surgery called minimally invasive cardiac surgery, MICS. Amy Edmondson, a professor at Harvard Business School, studied the way that 16 hospitals implemented MICS. Traditional open-heart surgery is very invasive. A patient's breastbone is split open. His or her blood is circulated through a heart-lung bypass machine, and the heart is stopped. MICS is much less invasive because it allows the heart to be fixed without the chest being opened. Surgeons sneak up to the heart through a small 3-inch incision between two ribs. Meanwhile, a tiny catheter with a deflated balloon is threaded through the groin, guided into the aorta, and then inflated, blocking blood flow from the inside. The surgeon proceeds to operate using the small, cramped, horizontal space between the ribs. That cramped operating space changes everything about the surgery. With open-heart surgery, the surgeon blocks off the aorta with external clamps, like putting a chip clip on a really precious bag of Doritos. No input is needed from the surgical team. With MICS, the balloon gizmo must act as an internal clamp, inflating to block the flow of blood. The surgeon can't see it or feel it, yet has to inflate it in exactly the right place at exactly the right pressure. To accomplish this, the surgeon must rely heavily on the anesthesiologist to monitor the path of the balloon as it moves toward the heart. Once the balloon is finally in place and inflated, the work still isn't done. The balloon's position has to be monitored continuously to make sure blood isn't flowing past it. As one nurse said, "When I read the training manual, I couldn't believe it. It was so different from standard cases. The procedure requires precarious maneuvers in a life-or-death situation by a team mostly blinded, kind of like landing a jet on an aircraft carrier at night. Not that we know what either of these things feels like. We just picture both being substantially more dangerous than writing a nonfiction book. But there's a big payoff for these precarious maneuvers, a lot less suffering for the patients. MICS heart patients go home from the hospital in 4 days instead of 8, and they recover fully in 3 weeks instead of 2 months. The promise of MICS, then, is that it offers big benefits to the patients of teams that adopt it, but only if the surgery teams are willing to endure the initial learning period. Lots of new technologies require this trade-off. Think of architects who stopped creating drawings by hand and started using computer-aided design, or distributors who learned to use PDAs in the field to track their shipments and deliveries. Pain now for a payoff later. Edmondson studied 16 hospitals as they adopted the new MICS technology. She found that some hospitals successfully learned and embraced the new technique, but several failed and retreated back to open-heart surgery. What she learned about the successful and unsuccessful teams is powerful testimony to the power of the growth mindset. 11. The most effective teams tended to adopt what Edmondson called a learning frame. Members of these teams pictured MICS as something that would be difficult at first, but would get easier over time if they were to open to changing how they behaved and communicated. At Mountain Medical Center, Dr. M. adopted a learning frame. He often wore a head camera, which allowed the team to see what was going on, and he encouraged questions about what he was doing and why. He also made sure his team practiced diligently. He deliberately scheduled the first 6 MICS cases in the same week so team members could practice repeatedly with no chance of forgetting what they were learning in the lag times between cases. He also ensured that the same team would be together on the first 15 cases. After that, he added new members one at a time so each new person could learn without introducing much risk to the procedure. Mountain Medical Center had great success using MICS, and this success can be attributed to the growth mindset. Dr. M. put the focus on practice. He acted as a coach, and he set up the routines to allow maximum chances to learn and improve. Other hospitals abandoned their adoption of MICS. At Decorum Hospital, the chief cardiac surgeon, Dr. D., was motivated to adopt MICS for competitive reasons. "We'd like everyone to know we can do it. It's a marketing thing. Patients want to know we can do it." His team members talked about adopting the procedure to keep up with the Joneses, the other large hospitals in the area. MICS, then, was seen almost like a desirable new toy to be acquired, especially since all the cool kids had one. Dr. D. ended up implementing the procedure in a unique way. He continued to split the breastbone of his patients, albeit with a smaller incision. One of his nurses remarked, "Dr. D is a creature of habit, and the old habits eventually won out." The use of the new procedure gradually dwindled, and eventually it was abandoned. Across the hospitals she studied, Edmondson found that the teams who failed made the mistake of trying to get it right on the first try, and were motivated by the chance to perform, to shine, or to execute perfectly. But of course, no one shines on the first few tries. This mindset set the teams up for failure. By contrast, the successful teams focused on learning. They didn't assume that mastery would come quickly, and they anticipated that they'd face challenges. In the end, they were the ones who were more likely to get it right. Failing is often the best way to learn, and because of that, early failure is a kind of necessary investment. A famous story about IBM makes that point well. In the 1960s, an executive at IBM made a decision that ended up losing the company $10 million, about $70 million in 2009 dollars. The CEO of IBM, Tom Watson, summoned the offending executive to his office at corporate headquarters. The journalist Paul B. Carroll described what happened next. As the executive cowered, Watson asked, "Do you know why I've asked you here?" The man replied, "I assume I'm here so you can fire me." Watson looked surprised. "Fire you?" he asked. "Of course not. I just spent $10 million educating you." 12. In 1995, Molly Howard, a longtime special education teacher in Louisville, Georgia, watched as the new Jefferson County High School building was being built. "Every day I'd drive by the building and I'd wonder, who's going to run that school? And it kept tugging at me. Why don't you apply?" Howard said. She applied and got the job, but with the promotion came a very tough challenge. 80% of the school's students lived in poverty. Only 15% of students in the previous high school had continued on to college. "The kids you'd expect to be successful were successful," said Howard. "But what about the other 85%? Many teachers had a nearly defeatist attitude. There was this belief that some children can and some children can't, that we're here for the ones who can get it, and we've got to accept that we're going to lose some. I knew I'd have to challenge that," said Howard. Howard acted quickly. First, she had to sell a new identity. Howard believed that every student could aspire to go to college, so she abolished the school's two-track system that had separated college-bound students from vocational students. In her school, everyone would share the college-bound identity. She beefed up assessments and tutorial programs. She matched students with teachers who'd be their on-campus advisors through all 4 years. Perhaps her most distinctive change, though, was to the grading system. Under her new system, the only grades offered at Jefferson County High School were A, B, C, and NY. Not yet. In Howard's view, the students at Jefferson had accepted a culture of failure. In a fixed mindset way, they acted as though they were failures to the bone. Students often didn't do their homework, or they turned in shoddy work. Getting a D or an F was an easy way out, in a way. They might get a poor grade, but at least they would be done. In the new system, the students couldn't stop until they'd cleared the bar. "We'd define up front to the kids what's an A, B, and C," said Howard. "If they do substandard work, the teacher will say, 'Not yet.' That gives them the mindset, 'My teacher thinks I can do better.' It changes their expectations." The school was reborn. Students and teachers became more engaged. The school's graduation rate increased dramatically, and student test scores went up so much that remedial courses were eliminated. In 2008, the National Association of Secondary School Principals declared Howard the U.S. Principal of the Year out of 48,000 candidates. Howard transformed her students. She cultivated a new identity in them. "You're all college-bound students." Then she flipped Jefferson from a fixed-mindset school to a growth-mindset school. She believed that every student was capable of doing acceptable work, that no student was doomed to failure. There's no never at Jefferson anymore, only a not yet. 13. In times of change, we need to remind ourselves and others again and again of certain basic truths. Our brains and our abilities are like muscles. They can be strengthened with practice. We're not born skateboarders or scientists or nurses. We must learn how to skateboard, do science, or care for sick people. And our inspiration to change ourselves comes from our desire to live up to those identities. In the story of Molly Howard, we see that amazing things can happen when you combine the aspiration of a new identity with the persistence of the growth mindset. That's how you grow your people. Over the past few chapters, we've seen that the central challenge of change is keeping the elephant moving forward. Whereas the rider needs direction, the elephant needs motivation. And we've seen that motivation comes from feeling. Knowledge isn't enough to motivate change, but motivation also comes from confidence. The elephant has to believe that it's capable of conquering the change. And there are two routes to building people's confidence, so that they feel big relative to their challenge. You can shrink the change or grow your people, or preferably both. Our picture of change is still incomplete, though, because it's clear that in some situations, even a reluctant elephant and a confused rider will manage to change their behavior. For instance, consider the fact that even a lost, angry driver who is hopelessly late for an appointment will stop dutifully for a red light. That's why, to make changes stick, we've got to think about shaping the path. Shape the Path. Chapter 8. Tweak the Environment. 1. When some guy cuts you off in traffic, you probably think instinctively, "What a jerk." Or perhaps your inner voice is more vulgar. What you almost certainly don't think to yourself is, "Gosh, I wonder what's wrong that he is in such a hurry." It's not hard to see why we don't think that. It seems kind of naive, as if we're making an excuse for a bad person. But think about your own behavior. Think of a time when you were driving so crazily that others would have been justified to curse you. Was your crazy driving on that day a manifestation of your true character, i.e., you're a jerk to the core? Or was it sparked by the situation you were in? In the very first story in Chapter 1, about moviegoers who ate more popcorn when given bigger buckets, we saw how easy it can be to jump to conclusions about people. If we hadn't known about the effect of bucket size, it would have been easy to conclude that the big bucket people were popcorn-gorging gluttons. But of course, the surprising part of the study is that when you give people a giant bucket, they become popcorn-gorging gluttons. And when someone behind the wheel of a car is 20 minutes late for a crucial appointment, that person becomes a terrible driver. What looks like a person problem is often a situation problem. The same phenomenon holds true in the business world. W. Edwards Deming, the chief instigator of the total quality management movement that revolutionized manufacturing, told a story about a company that used a variety of flammable products in its production process. Unsurprisingly, fires frequently broke out in its plants. But the president of the company didn't think he had a situation problem. He thought he had a person problem. He sent a letter to every one of the company's 10,500 employees, pleading with them to set fewer fires. What looks like a pyromania problem is often a flammable chemical problem. We are frequently blind to the power of situations. In a famous article, Stanford psychologist Lee Ross surveyed dozens of studies in psychology and noted that people have a systematic tendency to ignore the situational forces that shape other people's behavior. He called this deep-rooted tendency the fundamental attribution error. The error lies in our inclination to attribute people's behavior to the way they are rather than to the situation they are in. The fundamental attribution error complicates human relationships. Marriage therapist Michelle Wiener Davis said, "Most people attribute their marital problems to some deeply ingrained personality characteristics of their spouse. A wife might say, 'My husband is a stubborn person.' But Wiener Davis might respond, 'You've got to admit that your husband isn't always stubborn. He doesn't resist when his coworkers suggest a new client approach at work, and he doesn't drag his feet when you propose new ways to handle the family's finances.' The stubbornness emerges mainly when you suggest a new approach with the kids at home, and when you do that, he is stubborn almost every time. It's the situation, not an immutable stubbornness built into his character, that produces the behavior. This doesn't excuse his stubbornness, of course, but it should provide hope for a solution, since situations should be easier to tweak than people's core character. The fundamental attribution error is the reason why we love TV shows like The Dog Whisperer or Supernanny, in which seemingly irredeemable dogs and kids are tamed by outsiders who come in with a new system of discipline. At the beginning of the episodes, we're presented with a dog that bites everything in sight, or a child who won't obey the simplest of commands, and we simply can't avoid jumping to conclusions about their character. That dog is vicious. That boy is a terror. And when they're reformed in the course of a short intervention, it blows our minds. If we could cure ourselves of the fundamental attribution error, these shows would seem obvious to the point of absurdity. It would be like watching a show whose premise was that if you take scalding hot liquids, dangerous and slippery, and stick them in the freezer for a long time, they renounce their fiery former selves and turn to ice. Now you can see why the third element of our framework, the path, is so critical. If you want people to change, you can provide clear direction, rider, or boost their motivation and determination, elephant. Alternatively, you can simply make the journey easier. Create a steep downhill slope and give them a push. Remove some friction from the trail. Scatter around lots of signs to tell them they're getting close. In short, you can shape the path. 2. To see how a smoother path can change behavior, consider some research that studied why college students did, or didn't, donate food to a canned food drive for charity. The researchers knew some students would be more charitable and generous than others, and would be more inclined to donate food. The researchers wondered, can we alter the situation so that jerks give, too? First, to distinguish saints from jerks, they polled all the students in a particular dorm, asking them to assess which of their dorm mates, out of roughly 100, were most likely and least likely to make a donation. Once they compiled those rankings, they had a pretty good idea of which students were charitable or uncharitable types. Then they altered the path. Some students received a basic letter announcing the launch of a food drive the following week and asking them to bring canned food to a booth on Tresidder Plaza, a well-known spot on campus. Other students received a more detailed letter, which included a map to the precise spot, a request for a can of beans, and a suggestion that they think about a time when they'd ordinarily be near Tresidder Plaza so they wouldn't have to go out of their way to get there. The two letters were randomly sent to the saints and the jerks. A week later, after the food drive was over, the researchers had a precise list of who had given food and who hadn't. The students who received the basic letter were not very generous. Only 8% of the saints donated, and not a single one of the jerks. So far, the jerks were living up to their reputation, but the saints weren't exactly outperforming. Then came the shock. Students who received the more detailed letter were substantially more charitable. 42% of the saints donated, and so did 25% of the jerks. This is an inspiring result. These researchers got 25% of the worst individuals in the dorm to donate simply by smoothing the path a bit. Bottom line, if you're hungry and need a can of food, you're 3 times better off relying on a jerk with a map than on a budding young saint without one. What's more, the path wasn't changed in any dramatic way. The letter just gave moderately more concrete instructions. Imagine what would have happened with a more aggressive intervention. What if volunteers had gone door to door collecting the canned food? What looks like a people problem is often a situation problem, and no matter what your role is, you've got some control over the situation. 3. Today, as you go through your day, notice how many times people have tweaked the environment to shape your behavior. Traffic engineers wanted you to drive in a predictable, orderly way, so they painted lane markers on the roads and installed stoplights and road signs. Grocery store managers wanted you to spend more time in their store, so they positioned the milk coolers all the way at the back. Your boss's boss wanted to encourage more collaboration among employees, so she approved an open floor plan layout with no cubicles or dividers. The bank was tired of your leaving your ATM card in the machine, so now the machine forces you to remove it before you can claim your cash. Tweaking the environment is about making the right behaviors a little bit easier and the wrong behaviors a little bit harder. It's that simple. As an inspiration, think about Amazon's one-click ordering. With one-tenth the effort of dialing a phone number, you can buy a new book or DVD. Talk about instant gratification. Amazon site designers have simply made a desired behavior, you spending money on their site, a little bit easier. They've lowered the bar to a purchase as far as humanly possible, at least until they launch one-blink ordering. By doing this, they've generated untold millions of dollars in incremental revenue. The opportunities are endless for simple one-click style tweaks. A few years ago, a consultant named Peter Bregman was asked to help a management consulting firm with an administrative problem. Employees weren't submitting their timesheets on time, which slowed the firm's billing because charges to clients were based on hours worked. Traditionally, the consultants had submitted their timesheets on paper, and they'd done so pretty reliably. Then, the firm developed an online timesheet tool. Consultants weren't using it. The executives held education classes to explain the new tool, but people kept on submitting their timesheets on paper. Frustrated, the executives tried using fiat power, announcing that the new online tool was mandatory. That worked for about half of the employees, said Bregman. The rest simply ignored it. The executives were ready to escalate the battle. They prepared a memo saying that people wouldn't get their paychecks unless they used the online tool. Side note. In our experience, people who are trying to change things often reach instinctively for carrots and sticks. But this strategy indicates a pretty crude view of human behavior, that people act only in response to bribes and punishments. And it quickly becomes absurd. Are you going to break out the no-paycheck stick for every change you want to make in your workplace? Bregman put the brakes on. Wait, he said. Do we know why people aren't doing the online timesheet? The executives assumed that the consultants were Luddites, or simply, obstinate. Classic labels inspired by the fundamental attribution error. Bregman persuaded the executives to do a bit more investigation. The employees who turned in paper timesheets were asked why they weren't using the online tool. Paper was easier, they said. Skeptical, the interviewers asked if they could observe the employees while they filled out the online timesheet. The results were telling. Lots of employees started grousing as soon as they encountered the wizard that was built into the online tool. Ironically, the wizard was intended to help people fill out the form. Think of the annoying paperclip guy in Microsoft Office who wants to help you write a letter. Now, imagine you have no choice but to accept his help. When the executives killed the wizard, allowing people to skip directly to the form itself, compliance rates rose immediately, and within a few weeks, everyone was using the online tool. People weren't being defiant, said Bregman. They were just proceeding on the easiest path. What's sadly typical about this story is that the executives didn't initially look for a path solution. Instead, they wanted to spook the elephant by threatening to withhold a paycheck. Bregman says they were mentally stuck. Well, I already asked them to do it. I taught them how to do it. I told them they had to do it. I don't know what else to do. At that point, the executives felt they'd tried every tool in their toolbox, so they jumped to punishments. We're taught to focus on incentives by our business background, says Bregman, or even our parents. Do this or you won't get your allowance. But executives and parents often have more tools than they think they have. If you change the path, you'll change the behavior. This clinic demonstrates the issue. Can you get problem students to come to class on time? Situation. Bart Miller, an American history teacher at Lincoln High School in Portland, Oregon, is frustrated by a few of his students, like Robbie and Kent, who frequently arrive late and then sit in the back of the room talking to each other and laughing and disrupting the class. Miller has tried getting tough with them, being strict and even sending them to the principal a few times. Nothing seems to work. What can he do to get these students under control? Bart Miller and the situation are real, but the kids' names are disguised. What's the switch, and what's holding it back? If Miller tries to get Robbie and Kent to act like model students, he'll be doomed to fail. Let's focus on the critical move. Miller wants Robbie and Kent to be in their seats before the class starts. If he manages to succeed with that, no small feat, he can keep snowballing the change. What's holding back the switch? Let's face it. This probably isn't a rider problem. Robbie and Kent know exactly when they're supposed to be in their seats, so we won't even think about the rider. It's an elephant problem. The kids aren't enthused about showing up on time, especially if doing so means less time hanging out with their friends in the hallways. The path might also play a role. Are there aspects of the environment or culture that make it easier for the kids to get away with their tardiness? How do we make the switch? Direct the rider. Not applicable. The teens know what is expected of them. Motivate the elephant. 1. Find the feeling. Maybe the kids see Miller as an abstract authority figure, rather than as a human being. Imagine a one-on-one conversation with each kid in which Miller says, "I feel stressed out because I'm expected to cover so much material in so little time, and that's how I'm judged. And I know you don't think it's a big deal when you're a few minutes late, but it makes my chances of doing a good job harder and harder. Can you do me a favor and just get here a second or two early?" Depending on the kid's empathy level, this might work, or more likely, will fail utterly. Shape the path. 1. Tweak the environment. Lock the door when the bell rings so latecomers are stuck in the hallway. 2. Build habits. Start having a daily quiz with one or two quick questions at the beginning of every class. If Robbie and Kent aren't present to take the quiz, they'll fail. 3. Rally the herd. Post a class on-time record on the wall. Maybe when Robbie and Kent see that they're the only students violating the social norm to be on time, they'll change their ways. 4. Build habits. Set a policy that the last student in his or her seat every day will be asked to answer the first question. 5. Rally the herd. Find a way to let Robbie and Kent know that the other students dislike what they're doing, as they almost certainly do. Often troublemakers have the illusion that their defiant behavior makes them folk heroes. They can be deflated quickly by frank peer feedback. 6. Tweak the environment. Do what Bart Miller actually did. He bought a used couch and put it right at the front of the classroom. It was immediately obvious that this couch was the cool place to sit. Students could slouch and relax instead of sitting at a dorky desk. Suddenly, Robbie and Kent started getting to class early every day so they could get a good seat. They were volunteering to sit at the front of the classroom. Genius. 4. Becky Richards worked at Kaiser South San Francisco Hospital, where nurses administer about 800 medications a day. Medication administration is what happens between the time a doctor prescribes a certain medication, such as 100 milligrams of ibuprofen, and the patient receives it. Nurses take the doctor's chicken scratch prescription, transcribe it so it's legible, then fax the order to the pharmacy. When the medication arrives from the pharmacy, they deliver it in the right dosage by the right method, IV, drip, injection, orally, to the right patient at the right time. Nurses have an impressive accuracy record. On average, they commit approximately one error per 1,000 medications administered. Still, given the huge volume of medications delivered at Kaiser South, that error rate led to about 250 errors annually, and a single error can be harmful or even deadly. For instance, if a patient receives too much heparin, a blood thinner, the patient's blood will no longer clot and the patient could hemorrhage. If a patient gets too little heparin, the patient could develop a blood clot that could lead to a stroke. Richards, who was director of adult clinical services at Kaiser South, and her nursing staff, wanted to drive down medication errors. Richards believed that most errors happened when nurses were distracted. It was easy to become distracted, because in most traditional hospitals, the medication administration areas are right in the middle of the nursing units, which tend to be the noisiest places on the floor. From memory, Richards quoted Tess Pape, a professor at the University of Texas, who has studied medication errors, saying, "Today we admire people for multitasking. We celebrate people who can accomplish many things at once. But when you're giving out medications, it is the last time you should be multitasking." Put yourself in Richard's shoes for a moment. Your goal is clear. Change your nurses' behavior so they can focus better, so they're less likely to get distracted. How can you accomplish that? First, you need to identify the core problem. The nurses understand what's expected of them. The critical moves are clear, so this isn't a rider problem. Nor do the nurses have any emotional resistance to better focus. In fact, it annoys them when they're distracted by others, which means that in this case, we have the luxury of a supportive elephant. The problem, it seems, is the distractions themselves. No one thinks twice before calling out to a nurse who's walking the halls delivering medication. Worse, nurses feel an obligation to respond when others distract them. No one wants to tell a surgeon, "Sorry, bub, can't help right now. I'm dealing with medication." Yet, that's exactly what needs to happen if errors are to be reduced. What Richards needed to do was make other people aware that they were interrupting the nurses. She needed to make the bad behavior visible. Ideally, when the nurses were administering medication, they would work inside a soundproof bubble, like the cone of silence from Get Smart. With that solution being architecturally infeasible, Richards came up with the idea of using a visual symbol, something that could be worn by nurses, that would signal to other people, "Hey, don't bother me right now. I'm passing out medication." After considering armbands and aprons, Richards settled on vests and decided to call them medication vests. Where do you buy a medication vest? Richards had to make do with what she could find. The first vest we ordered was off the internet. It was really cheesy. Cheap plastic. Bright orange. Be careful what you order off the internet. Later, with vests in hand, Richards unveiled the idea to her staff. When you're administering medication, you'll put on a medication vest. It's bright enough that people can see it from down the hall, and all of us, including the doctors, will know that when someone is wearing one of these vests, we should leave that person alone. She selected two units at Kaiser South for a 6-month pilot study of the medication vests, and in July 2006 it began. Richards quickly encountered a problem. The nurses hated the vests. So did the doctors. Nurses thought the vest was demeaning, and they couldn't find it when they needed it, said Richards. They didn't like the color. They'd ask, "How do you clean it?" And physicians hated not being able to talk to their nurses when they passed them in the hall. The nurses' written feedback was scathing. "Oh, so you want to draw attention to the fact that we can make a mistake? You want people to think I have a dunce cap on? That I'm so stupid I can't think on my feet? Give me a hard hat and a cone and I can go work for Caltrans, the state highway department." They were pretty brutal, said Richards. The reception was so universally poor that Richards was ready to write off the idea and try something else. Then the data came back. During the 6-month trial period, errors dropped 47% from the 6 months prior to the study. "It took our breath away," said Richards. Once the data were in, the hatred faded. Impressed by the results, the entire hospital adopted the medication vests, except for one unit that insisted they weren't needed. Errors dropped by 20% in the first month of the hospital-wide adoption, except in one unit, which actually saw an increase in errors. Guess which one? You know you've got a smart solution when everyone hates it and it still works. And in fact, works so well that people's hate turns to enthusiasm. Becky Richards had found a way to change the path. 5. The airline industry has long used a consistent practice, because most aircraft accidents happen during takeoffs and landings, the most hectic and coordination-intensive parts of any flight. The industry adopted the sterile cockpit rule. Any time a plane is below 10,000 feet, whether on the way up or the way down, no conversation is permitted in the cockpit, except what's directly relevant for flying. At 11,000 feet, members of the cockpit crew can talk about football, their kids, or the loathsome passengers, but not at 9,500 feet. One IT group adopted the sterile cockpit concept to advance an important software project. The group had embraced a substantial goal to reduce new product development time from 3 years to 9 months. In previous projects with tight deadlines, the work environment had become increasingly stressful. When workers fell behind schedule, they tended to interrupt their colleagues for quick help, and their managers would wander by regularly and ask to be statused on the project. As a result, the software engineers were interrupted more and more, and work weeks expanded to 60 and 70 hours as people started showing up on weekends, hoping to get some work done without interruption. The leaders of the IT group decided to try an experiment. They established quiet hours on Tuesday, Thursday, and Friday mornings before noon. The goal was to give coders a sterile cockpit, allowing them to concentrate on complex bits of coding without being derailed by periodic interruptions. Even the socially insensitive responded well to this change in the path. One engineer, previously among the worst interrupters, said, "I always used to worry about my own quiet time and how to get more of it, but this experiment made me think about how I'm impacting others." In the end, the group managed to meet its stringent 9-month development goal. The division vice president attributed this accomplishment to the sterile cockpit quiet hours. "I do not think we could have made the deadline without it," he said. "This is a new benchmark. In these disparate environments, airplane cockpits and hospitals and IT work groups, the right behaviors did not evolve naturally. Nurses weren't naturally given enough space to work without distraction, and programmers weren't naturally left alone to focus on coding. Instead, leaders had to reshape the path consciously. With some simple tweaks in the environment, suddenly the right behaviors emerged. It wasn't the people who changed. It was the situation. What looks like a people problem is often a situation problem." 6. We've seen lots of environment tweaking in organizations, offices and airlines and hospitals. But make no mistake, we can turn these tools on ourselves too. Many people have discovered that when it comes to changing their own behavior, environmental tweaks beat self-control every time. For instance, Brian Wansink, the author of the Popcorn Bucket Study described in Chapter 1, has a devoted following of dieters who swear by his prime directive, shrink your dinnerware, use smaller plates, bowls, and cups. Wansink knows that if we use big plates, we feel obligated to cover them with food. A half-full plate feels morally wrong somehow. And because we're wired to finish what's on our plate, that's a big problem. Big plates equal big portions equals overeating. To achieve eating control, according to Wansink, you must start with plate control. Store your dinner plates in a box in your closet, and start eating dinner every night off your salad plates. Use small wine glasses, not huge goblets. Never eat snack food directly out of the bag or box. Instead, pour a reasonable portion on a small appetizer plate. These are very simple environmental tweaks. Swapping out the plates and bowls and glasses in your cabinet have huge effects on eating behavior. We all play these games with ourselves, trying to nudge ourselves to do the right thing. We know a guy who religiously lays out his jogging clothes and shoes before he goes to sleep. That way, when he wakes up, it's just a tiny bit easier to get going. Another friend never goes to bed without setting the coffee pot to auto-brew at wake-up time. The aroma of fresh brewed coffee helps to fight the oversleeping urge. And there's a woman who actually freezes her credit card in a block of ice, so that when she feels the urge to spend, she forces herself to have a cooling off, or rather a warming up period. Self-manipulation works. Amanda Tucker used these same environment tweaking principles to improve her management style at work. Tucker was the country manager for Nike in Vietnam. She traveled frequently to visit factories in outlying regions, and while she was out of the office, work piled up. When she returned home, she was often overwhelmed. "I had more plates spinning than I felt I could handle," she said. It was tempting to shut her office door and plow through the accumulated work, but she knew it was important to stay accessible to her team. In fact, she established an open-door policy, allowing the individuals who reported to her directly to see her at any time she was in town. 9 months into the job, Tucker solicited feedback from her team members about her performance as a manager. She was astonished when they complained that she didn't seem to have time to talk to them. "Some of them were offended that when they walked into my office, I would often continue to look at my computer screen and type while they were talking. Of course, this gave them the strong signal that what I was doing was more important to me than they were," Tucker said. She knew they were right. It was a bad habit. And she also knew that the layout of her office was encouraging the habit. When people came in to see her, they sat in chairs across from her desk. When she faced them, she still had the computer monitor in her field of view. So it was easy, too easy, for Tucker to glance back and forth from their faces to the screen. Tucker simply rearranged her office. She moved the desk so it no longer separated her from her guests, and she added a meeting area with two small couches and a table. Now, when she was facing the people who came to see her, the computer was completely out of sight. No more temptation. Just by rearranging the furniture, I was able to connect much better with people who came to see me, she said. 6 months later, she solicited more feedback and was pleased that her communication scores had soared. If you'd seen Tucker's initial performance appraisals, you might have concluded that, despite her stated open-door policy, she was one of those insensitive managers who never listened to their subordinates. And you would have been committing the fundamental attribution error. Simply by rearranging the furniture in her office, Tucker made herself into a different kind of person. That's the power of shaping the path. 7. There is something satisfying about outsmarting ourselves. By now you realize what outsmarting ourselves means, that our riders are outsmarting our elephants. Tucker's solution was appealing in its elegance, a seemingly messy management problem solved by an afternoon office makeover. Tucker shaped her environment to disallow her own bad behavior. This is a topic that hits home for the two of us, your co-authors. While we were writing this book, we got annoyed by our tendency to get distracted by email. We were aware of the irony of our giving advice to readers about reining in their elephants while our own elephants habitually prompted us to check Outlook. So we decided to take some of our own medicine. If you use Microsoft Outlook, you know that when you get new email, an alert sound plays through your computer's speakers. That sound is like digital catnip. How can you not check your mail when you hear it? What if a rich Nigerian politician went down in a plane crash and you had a limited time to capture part of his fortune? Chip decided to tweak his environment. He rummaged through the control panel until he found the place that allowed him to delete the email sound at the system level. Later he noticed that new email also triggered an alert icon on the taskbar. More irresistible bait for the elephant. He covered it with a post-it note blackened with one of his daughter's felt-tip markers. Now it can't torment him. Ignorance is bliss. Meanwhile, Dan went nuclear. He bought an old laptop, deleted all its browsers, and for good measure, deleted its wireless network drivers. Now, when he needs to focus, he takes the Wayback Machine with him to a coffee shop or library. There's no hope of getting online. He's been liberated by this restriction. Our struggles with email are a bit pathetic, but the larger topic is worth considering. Is it possible to design an environment in which undesired behaviors, whether yours or your colleagues, are made not only harder but impossible? As it turns out, lots of people actually make their living contemplating how to wipe out the wrong kinds of behaviors. Consider industrial safety. Many factories use dangerous machines that have a bad habit of lopping off fingers or hands that are in the wrong place at the wrong time. Suppose you're a factory foreman, and one of your workers